This podcast is an unedited excerpt from an MCLE program presented at MCLE's Conference Center in Boston, Massachusetts. Get 24/7 instant access to over 150 practice development e-lectures and more with a subscription to the MCLE Online Pass. Learn more at www.mcle.org/onlinepass.
Creating the attorney-client relationship. It can get created inadvertently or advertently. It can get created by someone believing that you are their lawyer when that wasn't your intent. So be conscious about it. You want to do the appropriate conflicts check to know who it is you're going to be representing. You want to pay special attention at the outset and have as many communications as you need about what the scope of the engagement is. Classic real estate case, a friend calls a lawyer and says, I got a closing coming up in a couple of weeks. Would you mind handling it? And the lawyer says, sure. I guess my instinct would be to stop at that point and saying, what are you getting into? And if you're into that problem, what is it you have to do? It turns out it wasn't a simple closing. It was an acquisition of a nursing home. There were certificates and inspections and due diligence items that had to be done. None of them were done. It wasn't done well. And the malpractice case ensued, of course. So be conscious of what it is you want to get into. Who is the client is critical. What is it you're going to be doing? Are you going to be getting in on a full scope of engagement or a limited scope of engagement? You want to deconstruct that as best you can. Like restaurants do with a Caesar salad. You have a piece over here, you have a piece over here. You want to know whether or not you're going to be involved in the full panoply of what the person is, which means you've got to be asking a lot of questions at the beginning. Now, clearly, a limited engagement or limited scope is beneficial if you ever get sued, because scope of engagement defense is important. And if you're going to be doing something on a limited basis, put it in writing. Don't wait for 6 months. I'm going to go back to the human piece about this, the fear or the embarrassment. If you're worried about losing the client, maybe that's a good thing. In the same way, we're going to talk dialing for dollars this afternoon. If a client won't pay you a retainer and one's required, be very wary, or take it on knowing you may never get paid. If you say to someone at the beginning, this is an area of unusual interest, or it's an area in which I don't generally practice, but I'll do it anyhow, it's probably a good idea to explore whether you really want to do that. If you don't have that conversation at the beginning, painful though you may think it's going to be, then it's going to be a lot more painful down the road. So, what is the relationship? Normally at this point, I would ask for people in the audience, but I'm not going to do that. An attorney-client relationship has a particular definition. So let me tell you what it is, and it's good to look at the cases occasionally to see this. Attorney-client relationship is someone who comes to you seeking advice or assistance from you, not as the next door neighbor, not as a friend, but as a lawyer. General counsel inside corporations have this problem all the time. I used to tell folks it was a good idea to have two pads of paper. One pad of paper is going to say attorney-client relationship on the top, and the other one's going to say business stuff. Think of it that way as well. If you're going to be handling a matter as a lawyer, you want to be clear that that's why the person's asking and that you're willing to do it. The second piece of that is the advice or assistance you are being asked to give is within our competence. Same point, more particular. If it's not within your area of competence, you don't want to spend your time learning it. There's the unfortunate excessive fee case, matter of Fordham. Lawyer did a terrific job, but the fee was very excessive and ended up with a discipline over it. The fee may have been excessive because this is not a matter the lawyer had ever handled before, and other professionals in the particular field, which is criminal defense work, a DUI, said, you know, we regularly do this for a quarter or 20% of the amount that was being charged. That goes to trying to get more experience. It doesn't matter, as it happened in Fordham, that the client wanted that lawyer to handle it. You need to address that from a question of competence. And this is a good place to build relationships with younger lawyers. Farm those cases out, get cases back, build your brand, talk about the kinds of things that are going to make it important for you to do that. Someone comes to you to give you a matter. It's within your, as a lawyer, it gives you the matter within your level of professional competence. So you're acting in that fashion. And then the contract. Here's the offer. I want you to do this. You now have the acceptance. Once you give that acceptance, which is I'll undertake the relationship, as Dorothy said, and she should say it 400 times, that needs to be in writing. I don't care if it's an email or a more formalized agreement, like an offer to purchase and then a formal purchase and sale agreement. Those of you know the real estate cases, an offer to purchase signed by both sides, if it has the material terms, can stand as a bound agreement. So if that's the point at which not only your ethics obligations arise, but your professional duties arise. Now, duties are owed in the relationship only to the client as client. Now, there are rare instances, as folks probably know, where non-clients can become inured to your detriment as a client, as somebody to whom duty is owed. The reasonable expectation, the detrimental reliance. You want to be very careful about that, which is the reason why you want to avoid implied relationships, those created by estoppel, those created by detrimental reliance. So if you have a duty that's going to arise in the creation of a relationship, that duty is now going to back to a client, and that gets you back to the question of who is the client. So those are the basic things. Now, let me add some other more poignant issues about dealing with human beings. Excuse me. This prospective client comes to you and you're about to establish an attorney-client relationship. What's your gut reaction about that person? Don't give that up. Don't ignore it. Get other people's advice. Have they had prior counsel? I suspect that every one of us has had somebody who has come to them and said, you know, you're my fourth lawyer, but I know you're going to do a terrific job. Well, I probably want to have a conversation, if they'll give permission, with the prior three lawyers, because that's a big red flag. Does this person tell you he or she knows the law and they're very good at understanding what the practice of law is? Does this person say, I don't care what it costs, it's the principle. Principle is very expensive, it's not very tasty, and many cases have gone down the tubes in relationships on principle. Can you take on the matter to create the relationship? Do you have the time, the resources, the available folks, and the money to do it? If you're taking on a PI case and the client expects you to front the money up front instead of getting a cost retainer, are you going to be able to do that? As indicated, is it within your level of competence? Or do you want to associate with outside counsel? I've never seen that as a sign of weakness. I've seen that as a sign of intelligence. You say to the prospective client, look, this isn't really my area. I'm happy to help out with it. I'll be glad to co-counsel with you on it. But I really want to bring in my friend Rodney, because this is an area that's really good, and we've done this before. And if so, we'll do a joint agreement. Or you can send the matter out on a referral basis and get an agreement signed by the client where the lawyers will split the fee. I'm going to talk about this now for 10 seconds. We're going to come back to it later. you really need to have discussion about fees up front, discussion about costs, who's going to fund them and where they're going to come from, who's going to be responsible for them, and get that in writing once you get started. I had somebody referred to me about 2 weeks ago and said, I'm really, you know, anxious to talk to you and I really want to engage you. And then I told this person what the cost would be and I never heard from them again. Now, that's fine in a lot of ways, because it means, although I, you know, I might not be able to assist that one person, I'm not going to be out a hell of a lot of time and money because that person couldn't afford it, or the folks who want to get things for free, and those folks still do exist. In the concept of the relationship, the focal point here is relationship. Attorney and client create a relationship. That's not just contractual, but that's personal. Have you given the client enough time to ask questions, the prospective client? How are you managing time in respect to that? Is the client going to say later, you never told me about this, which is why you want to put things in writing? What's your telephone policy? If somebody calls and you're not available, that should be true. For years, I loved doing office visits to go see my clients. So I was sitting in a lawyer's office in the waiting room, and the receptionist, I'm here, the receptionist is here, wherever my other finger is, there it is. And a call came in, and the receptionist said, oh, yes, Ms. So-and-so. And I happened to know exactly who so-and-so was. And the receptionist said, oh, Attorney X isn't here. And I'm sitting and staring at Attorney X, whose office is right in front of me down the hall. And I could see that person. You don't want to be doing that. This may seem silly, but once you or your staff starts down that road, managing the misrepresentations becomes a real problem, from tiny to huge. If you're going to get involved in a litigation matter, explain litigation up front before the agreement gets signed. If you want to get the client signed up in a contingent fee matter, you really want to explain to the client what it's about and how it's going to happen. Because it's very hard. Once a litigation piece gets started, it's hard to get out of it. It's also hard to get out of transactional work, but that goes in a slightly different direction because you don't need permission from a court. Have you avoided at all cost making a guarantee? You know, Irving, you've got a really good case. I would encourage people to stop saying that. If you're trying to lure the client in, lure him in on your intellect, not on your promises that you may not be able to keep. And as Dorothy and Rodney both said, have you been gracious and straightforward as you would want someone to be to you? Have you thanked the client or prospective client for contacting them? If you need to make a decision, you do that as you go. But you don't want to be leaving somebody with the impression that you're being insular or you don't care. It's their life. They're bringing their most concerted things to you, and you want to be able to respond to those in an appropriate way. Now, let me just emphasize other pieces of the creation of the relationship before we get too far down the road here. I don't really care, for the most part, what the format is, but some kind of memorialization of the agreement. Dear Melvin, it was nice talking to you today. I'd be happy to undertake the matter once I do a conflicts check. By the way, I bill at X dollars an hour, and that'll be the rate. And once we get past a conflicts check, if we agree to take it on, I'll send you a formal fee agreement. Simple email. Do you keep good copies of things? Copies are critical. If you're not going to be engaged, put it in writing. Don't say that there's a statute of limitations and here's what it is. Simply say, beware of the statute of limitations and I urge you to consult other counsel. Don't state that an attorney-client relationship or imply that an attorney-client relationship was created, but you're leaving it. State clearly, I want to inform you that we have not engaged in an attorney-client relationship and I appreciate your contacting me, but we're not going to be able to take the matter. If you end up in the weird place with the relationship of having to give ALA letters against legal advice, you're going to want to put that very much in writing, because that's a critical feature with respect to the relationship. Are you documenting things from the very outset? Jeff Graber will talk later when he gets on board about communications that are miscellaneous in nature. I have hundreds of files that Jeffrey taught me to do this 30 years ago when we practiced together. ABC calls you and on June 12th, 2020, and you have a file note, you make a piece of paper, and it's a relationship hasn't been created yet, or maybe it's just a consult. You want to put that off in a miscellaneous file under their name so you have a record of it. The other end of it, so we don't forget this piece, once you're done, send a disengagement letter. So it's clear that the relationship is over. Thank you very much for engaging us. We're pleased that the outcome was so good for you. And we hope you enjoyed the experience. But the matter is now concluded. I'll send you back your file unless you've dealt with that in your fee agreement. Make sure that that's clear and done. The last piece about this at this juncture is train your staff about confidentiality. Like my sitting in the waiting room and listening to a conversation in the open with some other lawyer I just happen to know. Not having the conversation in the elevator of the courthouse on your phone where everybody can hear it. Train your staff about what confidentiality is. Have that discussion in the very beginning. If you don't have a written protocol, have the discussion up front. Here's how things will flow into the office. What happens with telephone records? Do you have a record of the phone calls coming in? What happens with mail? Who's responsible for them? I once represented a lawyer who had some significant issues, and I went to his office to meet, and there was a giant cardboard box filled with mail that had never been opened. Lots of issues going on there. But if you've got an active office and people aren't having serious psychological issues, you want to make sure that mail is opened and that it gets communicated to the right place, and if files are set up in an appropriate way. Scan things in, create intelligent files. Jeff Graber is going to talk about this in great detail at the other end. The last thing, one more piece about confidentiality, which has to do with the relationship. Do vendors just wander into your office and wander about? I think that they had to be stopped at the gate and not let through except escorted. If you've got office sharing and everybody shares a fax machine or a copy machine and stuff's out there, you need to have those conversations with your office sharers about how you do that. If you're meeting with a client, now it's virtual, so it's a lot easier. But if you're meeting with somebody, and someday we will again, in a conference room, make sure the conference room is empty of everything except their stuff. I don't, not because I'm being unpleasant about it, but I don't let clients come into my office because I have lots of other people's confidential stuff there. And the stuff I deal with is particularly sensitive because it's all their lawyers' things. Make sure you talk to an employment counsel about dealing with employees when they come and go, who keeps things, who takes files with them, who doesn't, use of phones, office equipment, confidential lists, and all that. That's one of the things to add on to. So we've got some questions. Let me try to walk through these so that we don't get lost. And I probably run my lips about as long as I can at the moment. Somebody had a conflict of interest question. I have two clients. I wrote their standard template contract for each of them, a non-disclosure agreement. They want me to approve, and they want me to approve them to sign the NDA the exact same time. I'm not sure I understand the question fully. Rodney, if you're still alive, you want to jump in on this one. If you've got two clients and you get a standard template contract and an NDA, I assume that in that you have given advice that they should each consider consulting with independent counsel before they sign the NDA, and that it's clear what the relationship is between them, and that one of them is not a former client, so the other person thinks, well, you're really representing A and not B for us jointly. There's a billing question. We're going to take that up this afternoon when we dial for dollars. A question, does representation of the client end when a judgment is rendered, such as in the probate court, or when does it end? Some wise ass like me might say the representation never ends, but the representation ends when there's a full and final disposition of the case and the appeals periods have run, and that's on a piece of litigation. Judgment rendered such as in a probate court, well, if there's an appeal period, depends on what your fee agreement has said. So you want to be clear, and this is an important point, which will get talked about. David will talk about these later in terms of fee agreements. Are you taking on the matter through the appeal, up to the appeal? How is it being handled? But generally, the representation ends when you've either been discharged, you depart, you disengage, or when there's a final, full and final judgment, if it's contemplated. There's a couple of other billing issues. One of the interesting questions asked is, if a client has told counsel that he or she has seriously considered doing harm to the judge or other court personnel, what do you do? I'm going to ask this question again when other folks are back online, because I want to hear from Rodney and Dorothy in particular. But I'm blanking on the name. This is a Tarasoff question in the psychotherapy realm. I think that that raises significant questions about being able to act and communicate that. I think you need to explore that with the client, seek professional help about what to do. If the client has a spouse or some other person, you want to get permission to talk to that person in writing and find out what happens. But if worse comes to worst, if there's a specific plan or a threat to do harm to the court, I will terminate the relationship and I will communicate that to the court. And in fact, I had that in a case where the law student litigant on the other side made a not very veiled threat about to the judge, I know where you live. Smart move. Fortunately, it was done in open court and the court officer stepped in immediately and they started a state police investigation. Rodney, anything, thoughts about this problem?
Yeah, and Dorothy might have something to say to this also, but I think that the key is, even if you do have to make that kind of disclosure to protect the the individual that's being threatened, you want to limit your disclosure as much as possible. So sometimes these types of things become more public if the press reaches out to you. It's not now public, so you can't, in a way that would allow you to talk to the press about it. You want to limit any disclosure only to the extent that it's necessary to protect the person or property in question.
Take a look at Rule 1.6. I was just dialing it up on my...
Yeah.
Rule 1.6B, a lawyer may reveal confidential information relating to the representation of a client to the extent the lawyer reasonably believes necessary, or to the extent required by rules 3.3, 4.1, or 8.3, must reveal such information to prevent reasonably certain death or substantial bodily harm. And that's right in 1.6B1. To prevent the commission of a criminal act that's likely to result in substantial injury to property, financial or other significant interests. I think life is a significant interest.
Right.
So I think that's your savings grace in disclosing the matter. Since I have a partner and have had for many years, whom I met on the other side of a case and learned that he had been threatened harm and that somebody was coming to kill him, and the police jumped in and he called the police jumped in and called and literally saved his life. I don't have a lot of qualms about disclosing this to the appropriate authorities. And he's alive today because he worried about the confidentiality issues after the fact of trying to save his or somebody else's life. And there were three people who were threatened and all of them were protected. Dorothy, you got any thoughts about disclosure of
We do advise people that, the harm has to be imminent. I mean, the rule says reasonably certain death or substantially bodily injury. And a lot of times clients will make very kind of general threats or, make extreme statements about, their feelings about the judge or an opposing party or something like that. But, we tell people, unless it's a more of a specific kind of threat and something that the person would be capable of carrying out, that you still are obligated to keep it confidential.
I have always jumped in at that point and sought the advice of a good psychotherapist. Unfortunately, I'm married to one. So without names, I will talk about it or get a outside referral or try to get permission to talk to somebody in this client's family. If necessary, to see whether or not this is real. The question was posed, we're spending a little more time on this. This is not that unusual, unfortunately. If the client's told counsel he or she has seriously considered doing harm, I think Dorothy's commentary is right on that. I think you have to explore it, and I think we've got an obligation to explore it.